Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, Prime Minister, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's absolutely a pleasure and an honour to have been asked to introduce our guest speaker tonight, the Honourable Mr. Tony Abbott. In the 6 months or so since he's taken to office, he's demonstrated through his leadership that Australia must truly embrace a global mindset, particularly in the context of trade and trade with our Asian neighbours. The fact that the Prime Minister made it a priority to visit so many Asian countries in the short period since coming to office, the commitment made on his visit to Indonesia that he would always take a trade delegation with him, and then to achieve such important progress on trade agreements with some of our most significant trading partners, all of these clearly demonstrate the government's recognition of the reality that if we want to achieve our desired growth rate, that's predicated on expanding our trade opportunities. As business leaders, it's now up to us to make the most of the opportunities which have been created. However, the Prime Minister's visit did more than just build trade relationships. They've demonstrated an understanding that commercial relationships rely on the underlying people-to-people linkages. Tony Abbott demonstrates that he understands the significance of his personal relationship with other leaders. It's not easy to make such personal connections when you've got tight timelines and intense negotiations. But there is a strong sense that the Prime Minister did develop fundamental relationships with the leaders he met. And he's done it in his own way, which is so important when developing a basis of trust and respect. And this trust is vital, because if there's a problem, the greater the trust, the greater the chance of a speedy resolution from a conversation between leaders. And in fact, one of the most interesting and anecdotal indicators of both the importance of the relationship with Australia and the personal respect for the Prime Minister occurred in China, where it was a bit of an intimate gathering like this with only 1,800 guests in Shanghai. But what was so striking about that event was that everyone listened throughout the Prime Minister's entire speech. You could almost have heard a pin drop. But returning to the question of a global mindset, in visiting other countries, we see them all facing the same issues as we face here in Australia: the quest for growth, the challenge of job creation, and particularly jobs for youth, and all of this in rapidly changing environments. In all of the countries, we see national policies being purposely focused on these imperatives. So, Prime Minister, we look forward to hearing from you tonight on Australia's policies with purpose in a global context. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the stage the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott.
Catherine, thank you so much for that very warm introduction. I really appreciate you saying nice things about me in my presence. And I appreciate even more the nice things you said about me in the newspaper this morning. Thank you so much. Premier Mike Baird, parliamentary colleagues led by the Attorney General George Brandis, the Immigration and Border Protection Minister Scott Morrison, the Finance Minister and man in the budget hot seat Matthias Cormann, I acknowledge all of my other parliamentary colleagues. I particularly acknowledge three former premiers of New South Wales, Barry O'Farrell, John Fay and Nick Greiner. But most of all, I acknowledge all the friends and supporters of the Sydney Institute. It was about the middle of last year when Jared Henderson first asked me if I'd address this 25th anniversary dinner. My response was along the lines that you might not want me if the election goes the wrong way. It's to Jared's and the Sydney Institute's credit that he was prepared to take a punt on an opposition leader who was no sure thing. But Jared has always been prepared to have a go. It's made him one of our very foremost public intellectuals, and with Anne Henderson, he's made this institute a force for good in the life of our country. I'm pleased that this is the 10th time in 12 years that I've been able to address the Sydney Institute. I have to say that this will be my most economically focused address, because without a strong economy, it's impossible to have strong and sustainable communities. Economic growth is the means to a stronger society and a happier people. That's why my election pledge, endlessly repeated, was to build a strong and prosperous economy, not as an end in itself, but for a safe and secure Australia. Right now, Canberra is fixated on the coming budget, as we should be, because budgets matter. We're striving to achieve a stronger budget because that's the way to a stronger economy, to a stronger society, and to make your life better and your job more secure. On election night, I said that Australia was open for business, and every day since, we've been working to implement our economic action strategy. We promised to abolish the carbon tax and the mining tax, and we won't rest until they're gone. We promised to stop the boats and to end the $11 billion border protection cost blowout. And for the past 4 months, none have come, not a single one, compared to over 100 carrying more than 6,000 people in the same period last year. We said that we'd conclude free trade negotiations with Japan and Korea, and we have, and we've accelerated talks with China. We promised a one-stop shop for approving big projects. That's well underway, and we've given the green light to new projects worth over $400 billion. Yes, $400 billion worth of new projects have been given environmental approval since the election last year. We promised to cut red tape costs by $1 billion a year every year, and we've made a strong start, taking some 50,000 pages off the statute book, and the budget will do more. We promised to crack down on union officials who rip off their members, and that's happening. We promised an airport for Western Sydney, and with the help of the New South Wales government, that's happening too. We said that we wouldn't chase failing businesses, waving blank checks at them, because the end of the age of entitlement should start with the end of business welfare. Above all, in promising to deliver a strong and prosperous economy for a safe and secure Australia, we promised to get the budget back under control, because you can't fix the economy unless you fix the budget. Now, there's far more right about our country than wrong, and there's far more grounds for optimism about our future than worry. But we do have to get the economic fundamentals right. Prosperity is not a gift. We have to work for prosperity through being smarter and more diligent than our competitors. Like households and like businesses, governments have to live within their means. Every dollar that government spends is a dollar taken from the people in taxes or in borrowings. Everything that government does has to be paid for, either by today's taxes or tomorrow's taxes, with interest. And continuing a cycle of debt and deficit might briefly save a government from a bad headline, but it won't help you, the people, to plan a stronger and better future. A government that understands its limits is a government that allows the people to grasp their full potential. Because every time a government spends people's money for them, it limits their own freedom. Hence the famous dictum that government should do what the people cannot do for themselves and no more. As many of you would remember, the previous Liberal government in Canberra inherited $96 billion in net Commonwealth debt and a $10 billion budget black hole. It took the good work of John Howard and Peter Costello to produce surpluses averaging almost 1% of GDP, with almost $50 billion in the bank by 2007. I regret to say that this government's inheritance has been even worse. Labor debt and deficit stretches out as far as the eye can see. $123 billion in cumulative deficits over the next 4 years, and debt projected to reach at least $667 billion, which is $25,000 for every Australian man, woman and child, with $10 billion a year in interest repayments alone. At this level, countries no longer control debt. Debt starts to control them. There were roof bats that caught fire, school halls that cost twice the going rate, super clinics with no doctors, and the NBN that cost more and more to deliver less and less. The Labor government made vast open-ended commitments on schools and hospitals to take effect beyond the forward estimates period. They didn't just booby-trap the budget, they created a Ponzi scheme of unsustainable spending because they thought that new taxes, more spending and bigger bureaucracies were the answer to every problem. This budget will not change everything with one stroke. It won't offer a spurious guarantee of a surplus by a particular date. This budget will by no means be the only instalment in the long-term restructuring needed to restore our economic health. But this budget will bring us close to surplus over the forward estimates and on track to a strong surplus within a decade. This was the commitment we made pre-election, and this budget keeps faith with our election commitments. Prior to the election, we committed to abolish the school kids bonus that had nothing to do with education, and the income support bonus because these payments were a cash splash with borrowed money. There are other one-off payments that should never have been introduced and are unaffordable at this time. Prior to the election, we said we'd maintain school funding over the then forward estimates, but explicitly refused to commit to Labor's changes beyond that. The best way to improve schools is to give local communities more say, because parents and principals will be better than bureaucrats at getting the best possible value for taxpayers' dollars. Prior to the election, we said that we wouldn't cut overall health funding, but that we'd find ways of making health spending more efficient. Part of that will be more price signals in the system with a strong safety net, because free services to patients are certainly not free to taxpayers. Prior to the election, we said that we wouldn't cut the age pension. I want to assure vulnerable people that the age pension won't be less tomorrow than it is today, and that people turning 65 tomorrow are certainly not going to have to wait 5 years to retire. I'm confident that pensioners will be better off because they'll lose the carbon tax but keep the carbon tax compensation. Still, with 4 out of 5 seniors on the pension, the number of workers per retiree dropping from 5 to 3 by 2050, and more than 1,000 people becoming eligible for the age pension every single week, long-term reform is essential and unavoidable. To keep our commitments, there will be no changes to the pension during this term of Parliament, but there should be changes to indexation arrangements and eligibility thresholds in 3 years' time. There are other social security benefits where indexation arrangements and eligibility thresholds could be adjusted now. Adjusting indexation slows the rate of increase and helps to ensure that a strong social safety net can be preserved for everyone's future. And everyone will benefit from the abolition of the carbon tax, which damages our economy without helping the environment and which is costing the average household $550 a year. I know that most families are doing it tough, including many families with above average incomes but with heavy commitments. Not for a second would I label families as rich just because they're earning $100,000 a year. A teacher married to a part-time shop assistant with children to feed, clothe and educate is certainly not rich, especially paying a capital city mortgage. But the best way to help families on $100,000 a year is long-term tax relief and more business and job opportunities, not social security. The changes in this budget will make the personal tax cuts that we need much more likely in 4 or 5 years' time. Still, come budget night, I suspect that there won't be many without a potential grumble. But involving everyone in repaying Labor's spending binge is the only way to be fair. The budget pain will be temporary, but the economic improvement will be permanent. I can assure you that everyone will be involved, including high-income earners such as Members of Parliament. I know that the tendency on budget night is to focus on what's happening to me, but we need to focus on what's happening to us, because everyone needs to be involved in fixing Labor's debt mess if all of us are to prosper in the years ahead. This will not be a budget for the rich or the poor. It will be a budget for the country. It will be a nation-building budget, even though it cuts spending, because you can't build a nation by spending money you don't have in ways that don't build up your economic strength. So everything about this budget is calculated to boost the long-term strength of the economy, spending less on consumption so that we can spend more on capital, including human capital, in the areas at which we excel. Business programs will involve less bureaucracy and be more about backing businesses' own judgment. Training programs will focus less on trainer priorities and more on employer needs. Universities' funding will shift, but they will have much more freedom to innovate and to build on Australia's strength as a magnet for students, teachers and researchers from around the world. School leavers will be earning or learning, not becoming accustomed to unemployment. Starting in this budget for older people, for people with disabilities and women with young children, our aim is to maximise everyone's ability to participate in the economy. It's about driving change, but even more, it's about empowering choice. And of course, in a modern economy, that means more freedom to move around our cities rather than spending hours in some of the world's longest parking lots. This budget will fund our biggest ever national roads program and make it easier for the states to fund the metro roads and rail that commuters need. Now, I said earlier that budgets reveal the character of governance. They also show the mettle of countries. This budget is about shifting our focus from entitlement to enterprise, from welfare to work, from hand out to hand up, from our own short-term anxieties to our nation's long-term opportunities. Government's job is to make it easier for people to make big decisions, to build a house, to begin to study, to start a business, to employ someone, or to save for the future, and to make it more likely that people will decide to have a go. Because we can't be a generous society unless we are also a productive one. For the government, of course, there are political risks in this budget, but we owe it to our country, we owe it to everyone who elected us, to clean up the mess and to take decisions rather than to defer them. Without a clear economic plan, our standard of living will decline. With this budget plan, Australia can continue to be a beacon of prosperity, freedom and hope for the wider world. Now, serious people and serious countries must be able to have an adult conversation about the choices that we face. That's what the Sydney Institute has invariably tried to promote, and our country is the better for it. For too long, governments talked about being economically responsible but squibbed the big challenges. I don't expect the government to be more popular the day after the budget, but I do hope that we might have earned people's respect for saying what we mean and doing what we say. Ladies and gentlemen, my friends, thank you so much for your attendance here tonight. It is an honour to be at the Sydney Institute, one of the premier gatherings in this city and this country for the discussion of ideas, and I know that the discussion of ideas which permeates this evening will be for the long-term betterment of our country.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.